Spirit Radio Podcasts.
So how long did it take you to commute maybe to the public transport that you take into work or school or college? And is city congestion something that is having an impact on your life? It's something that I can especially see, obviously, living around Dublin. But is there modern technologies that can actually help with city congestion and perhaps also help with pollution as well by helping us to not have to take our cars so much? Well, there's things like e-scooters, but what are they all about and have they worked in other cities to help with traffic jams? On the line to give us his thoughts about this growing trend, we have Graham McQueen, who's Head of Communications at the Dublin Chamber. Graham, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Okay, so talk to me a little bit. We'll start off with e-scooters. For people who haven't seen too many of them whizzing around, what exactly are they?
Yeah, e-scooters, you see quite a lot of them around Dublin now. They're kind of growing in number. They look pretty much just like a normal scooter. You wouldn't really know. The reason you would know is that they go a bit faster and both the person's wheels would be on the scooter. So once you kick off on an e-scooter, there's a battery within the scooter which kicks in, and then that powers the scooter for quite a long distance, and then you're free to scoot around the city, but you do need to kick it off to begin with. So we're starting to see more and more of these coming around.
So how fast do they go, Graham, and how long would they last? Like, how long of a journey could you do on one?
They can, it would last you all day. You could scoot around, you could scoot to and from work, you get a good few hours out of them. In terms of speed, they can go quite quickly, and that's actually one of the issues that is being looked at is the speed of them. They can go like 25, 30 kilometres an hour, which is not bad. That's actually the speed limit along somewhere like the Keys. So they can get along pretty quickly, and we're finding more people looking at them just to get around the city.
Well, in terms of that, just because on the one hand you think, wow, it's great, you can whiz around from place to place, but on the other hand there's probably safety concerns given that they can go kind of 20 to 30 kilometres an hour, and if you were scooting around in kind of traffic time then you're probably going faster than a lot of the cars. Has there been much kind of in by way of looking at safety and regulation of e-scooters?
Yeah, there's a few kind of sticking points at the moment in the legislation. There's a bit of a grey area around the legislation. There's some people would say at the moment that you require a licence and tax and insurance for an e-scooter. That's because they're branded as mechanically propelled, and if you're a mechanically propelled vehicle, just like a car or a van, you need the licence and all that goes with it. Others would argue, people who are in favour of them would argue that that's not the case and they should be treated like e-bikes because you have to kick-start them. It's not the case that you don't turn a key, you don't press a button and the thing starts up. The human actually has to kick it off. So that's the difference. But it's a bit of a grey area. The government are looking at this at the moment. Dublin Chamber, who I represent, we've made our submission calling for e-scooters to be allowed. Then the other issue is, where do they go? So at the moment, you'll see them be coming off and on pavements. You'll see them in cycle lanes. You'll see them generally doing what bikes do. They tend to follow the same pattern as cyclists, really. But it all just needs to be kind of cleaned up. We need to know, are they legal? Can they use them? And then we need to decide where we want to use them. For my money, the cycle lanes would be the perfect way to get around the city.
And Graham, is there other cities that we can look to in Europe that have done this successfully, or how are e-scooters working in other countries?
Yeah, you'll find e-scooters in a lot of cities around the world. Like Lisbon, even London are looking at introducing them. The American cities, about 100 American cities where e-scooters are being used. And to kind of mixed success, I have to admit, like there's been, and one of the reasons for that is there are companies out there who provide dockless scooters, dockless e-scooters. So that's a bit like Dublin City Bikes is at the moment. So the scooters are left at certain areas around the city, and then people are free to use them as they wish. So they can pick them up and drop them. You pay like 25 cents for 10 minutes use or something like that. So I think the advantage Dublin has here is that we can learn from the experience of the other cities. They've all made mistakes. So we're coming at this kind of later day. I think we've got an advantage in that. I think we can use that to our advantage and maybe look to see how we can do things a little bit better. Because, believe me, I've been speaking to a number of companies over the last couple of weeks. There's a lot of big firms, e-scooter firms, looking to come and base themselves in Dublin. They're itching to come in and base themselves here. And they're just watching very closely to see what the government do in terms of legislation. legislation.
In terms of then what will happen next, obviously you've made a submission. What's the kind of timeline on that, Graeme, about the next steps?
So the submission was made to the Department of Transport. They have kind of kicked it over to the Road Safety Authority. They're looking at it and coming up with a recommendation. From what I believe, that recommendation will be published very, very soon. I'll be hoping to see that in the next couple of weeks. That will lay out whether their recommendation as to whether they should be allowed on our roads, whether they are mechanically propelled, whether they do need a licence, that sort of thing. And then it'll be up to the department then to whether they want to take that recommendation on board as a chamber. We'll be looking to speak to the department as well to make sure that they hear lots of different views. We'd be very keen to see Dublin embrace this type of technology. We find quite often when new things like this come along, we try and find a way not to make them happen, try and block them. And I think that's the wrong approach. This technology that we see in e-scooters, we're going to see this, you know, numerous other times in the coming years for different things. And we've got to be ready as a country to be able to embrace these. And I think at department level, we'd certainly be very keen for them to take a very proactive and positive approach to see how we can deal with technologies like this in a positive way.
I wonder if it's something that we can look at in tandem with what's happening in other cities, and obviously ones that are even bigger and more congested than the Dublin, places like London, where they, I think one of the things they're looking at is perhaps a licence or permit system. Is that the answer, that, you know, if you're going to be on a vehicle, whether you have to get it going yourself or not, but that if it can go, you know, 20 to 30 kilometres per hour, then it's reasonable that you should need to have some sort of a licence to use it?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be absolutely against it. I just think it's probably a little bit unnecessary. I think they should, to my mind, they should be treated more like bikes. I mean, would you want a licence for a bike? I mean, we're trying to encourage more people to use sustainable modes of transport, which bikes and e-scooters are. So I'd like to see them treated like bikes. I think bikes can go to that speed as well. Like, you see bikes flying around the city all the time. I think what it comes down to is common sense use. Do we want people zipping about it 40 kilometres an hour in pedestrian areas? Absolutely not. Like, that's not what these scooters should be for. I think they should be, you know, for sensible use, a bit like what you see bikes at the moment, for the most part. There are a few rogue cyclists about, of course, but I think a bit of common sense is required around these scooters at department level.
It's interesting that you're making the contrast, Graeme, with bikes, because I'm just wondering, do you see it kind of in the future where there is kind of e-scooter docks, you know, where you can, and I think you mentioned that does happen in other places, that you know, people who are working in a city, they don't necessarily have to own one, but if they're whizzing from like the north side of the city to the south side for a meeting or whatever, that they can do it quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd see a number of uses for it. Like, even using my own example, like, I have a 20-minute walk to my nearest train station, so am I going to make that walk every morning? Probably not. But if I had an e-scooter, that would probably take me 5 minutes. So if I could then, you know, fold up my e-scooter, all these e-scooters are foldable, get onto the train and then get off in the centre of the town and then jump back on the e-scooter and up to my office. That's kind of sensible. That's going to help things. That's going to stop me getting in the car in the morning, which I don't, by the way, actually take the bus. But there's many people out there, using that example, who jump in the car instead of making the walk to the train station or the bus stop or whatever it might be. So it's all about kind of sensible thinking in terms of joined up thinking in terms of transport.
You might have to use that same time, though, Graeme, to head to the gym if you're missing out on your morning walk. That's the only thing.
Well, that's the thing. I've seen people say it maybe is a bit lazy, you know, going on the e-scooter, but I don't know. I think it's like anything. I think if it forms part of your routine, you can get your exercise elsewhere, no problem.
Yeah, I've got just some messages coming in, so I'll just get to some of them. Hi, Wendy's a cyclist. I share a bike lane with scooters most evenings on the Grand Canal in Dublin. By and large, they don't cause an issue, and it means one less car on the road, provided they aren't too powerful. I'm in. They're easier and cleaner to maintain, and just interesting to hear from Joe in Dublin. One issue with them is the abuse of third world workers mining the raw materials to produce batteries for them. Interesting, Joe, must look into that, because I don't know if we'll get to that today, but it's an interesting discussion to be had as to whether e-scooters are going to take off. Graeme, thanks so much for joining us on the programme this morning. That's Graeme McQueen, Head of Communications at the Dublin Chamber, talking about e-scooters. But Joe, interesting, you know, I think we have to be responsible, if we're talking about responsibility and sustainability and that side of it when it comes to e-scooters and having less cars on the road, well, then of course they should have to be sustainably made and produced as well. So, very important point. My next guest was born in Belarus in 1993 in the aftermath of the Chernobyl disaster. As a newborn baby, she was abandoned and left in an orphanage where she experienced extreme neglect and abuse. Then at the age of 10, she was given hope, and when she was adopted by a family in Ireland through the A.D. Roach and Chernobyl Children International. It's the 33rd anniversary of Chernobyl, and on the line to mark United Nations Chernobyl Remembrance Day and to share a little bit about her story with us, we have Chernobyl survivor Raisa Carlin. Raisa, good morning and welcome to the programme.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
So take us a little bit back to your childhood of what you remember as a younger child living in Belarus, Raisa.
I guess the majority of the experience and memories that I have are from my childhood when I would have grown up in the orphanage and then eventually moved on into a mental asylum that I was put in at the age of 10. And it's just a lot of it's just negative, bad memories of being neglected and not being able to eat properly, walk properly, be able to go outside, play as a child and kind of be like a normal child. It was mostly just neglect, left in the cot all day and just not being able to do anything really.
And I mean, that is a horrendous enough experience, but you were born with particular problems with your leg and different things like that, so it probably made life even harder for you as a small child.
I was born with some medical conditions, which meant that I had a cleft palate, I had issues with my leg. So as a result of that, it definitely did, because I don't think they seen me as kind of a child as such, so I was just kind of left to the side a bit. So that definitely did make things difficult, because I wasn't able to walk until I came to Ireland. I wasn't able to eat properly until I got the proper care I needed, which wasn't until after the age of 6.
So 6 years old is when really things started to change, and it's hard to imagine you not being able to walk until you were 6 because of the way that you were treated, and that once that changed, that your life started to change. Tell us about what happened next when you were 6.
When I was 6, through AD and the Children's International, they took me over to Ireland through their programme, Rest of the Appropriation Programme. And I came over to Ireland at the age of 6, and I stayed with a few families within around the immediate region. And I started to kind of go and see doctors, and it came to the realization that in order for me to get the proper care I needed and to give me a better quality of life, I had to be in Ireland full time. So that is when my family here in Ireland, in need, the Carlin family, decided to take it upon themselves to then start the adoption process in order for me to be able to get the better quality of life and the help I needed.
It was incredible, really, because obviously it was meant to be for a shorter stay. The Carlins obviously fell in love with you, Raisa. Do you remember that time, or is it just kind of your family now telling you this is what happened?
It's a little bit of both, to be honest, because I was quite young when I came, but I do have kind of recollections of different small little things, and I always kind of laugh and say that I came in the back door and I just locked it and I said I'm not leaving. And it's just the difference between growing up in an orphanage then and coming to a loving family is very different as well. So you're getting the love and affection that you never got before, so you want to hold on to that. And then it's just everything else, you know, living in a house. And I used to have an obsession with switches when I first came, because I never experienced anything like it, so I used to switch them on and off all the time. And it's just little stuff like that would kind of do things like that. And my sister had a little newborn at the time, and when she would finish feeding her newborn, she would leave a little bit of milk in the bottle, and they often say to me that they'd find me at the back of the couch drinking the rest of the milk off the bottle, because I just didn't, it was food number one that I never really got much of, and it was just, that's just the way it kind of turned out to be.
So just normal family life and doing fun things that kids do, it was in such contrast. I know I heard, Raisa, for example, one stage you were locked in a cupboard with other children for days in the orphanage.
Yeah, the abuse kind of is anything from being locked in a room for a couple of days to being hit with belt buckles and nettles and just not being fed properly, to various things, really. So yeah, it's quite different to experience, a very different section when it came to Ireland.
And the hope and the love that you had here. But it wasn't easy, just in terms of from a health perspective. You've had a lot of surgeries since you've been living in Ireland, Raisa.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a lot of surgery. I've had over 30 surgeries and probably still counting to try and rectify all the issues. And as much as it's a lot, it also has given me the quality of life that I'm able to live now. So I have to kind of take a positive outlook on it, as much as it kind of has been a childhood of maybe being in hospitals in and out. But I have to look at the positive side of it as well.
And so you have finished your studies now. You've recently graduated. Tell us about that.
Yeah, last year I graduated from University College Cork with my master's in criminology. So that was something that I've been wanting to do for quite some time. And after I finished my degree in Galway, I then moved down to Cork and completed the studies in that. And recently enough, I'm finished doing an internship with the Road Safety Authority as well. So I'm getting a lot of experience and a lot of good things behind me.
And alongside that, you are finding the time also, you're a sportswoman as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I play wheelchair rugby sevens for the Irish squad. So we're actually preparing at the moment to go over to France in June for a Six Nations competition. So busy enough with that as well, yeah.
And a lot of training involved in that, I imagine, Raisa?
There is a bit of training, yes, but it's great. It's great to be able to be involved in something like that, you know, especially with the everything, the whole background and the disability aspects of it. It's great to be able to get involved in stuff like that and represent your country as well.
And another thing that you're involved in is you're an ambassador with Chernobyl Children International. In terms of just talking about Chernobyl, people might wrongly think, oh, this is something from the past, but of course, the effects are still being felt.
Absolutely, and you know, that is the number one reason why I love continuing to be involved in the Chernobyl Children's International. Not only am I sharing my story to raise awareness of what is still happening and going on in Belarus, because unfortunately there are still lots of children who are in orphanages who are living the life that I did live, and that's something that needs to be changed and made aware of. But it's also the fact that but it's still, even 33 years after today, there is a lot of lasting effects, and those will be felt for another long time, regardless of how many years it will be. There are still a lot of adults and radiation and a lot of issues that are still going on. And because it's 33 years on, a lot of people do think, oh, it's, you know, it is over 30 years ago. It can't possibly be anything. And unfortunately, it still is. And I think that's the big thing that we're trying to emphasize this year, especially, is that there is a long-lasting effect. And even myself being adopted 15, 16 years, it still has an effect on me as well in my everyday life.
In terms of your experience, and it must break your heart, Raisa, to think that what you experienced as such a young child is still happening to children in Belarus.
Absolutely. It's very disheartening, and it's, especially because I've gone through it, and because I've been looking up to come out the right side of it, but there are a lot of children who don't. And that is very difficult as in a society to accept that is going on. And that's why I'm gladly to be an ambassador for the charity, in order to try and make a change, try and make awareness that, you know, this is still raw, even though it's 33 years on.
So what needs to be done? What can people do in order to help then, Raisa?
Well, there's various programs that Children International provide and that run. Obviously, you know, donating is a big part of it, and they're very grateful for anything they can get. But you can get involved in various ways of, you know, rescue procreation programs. When we bring children over to volunteer to go over to Belarus themselves, but there's lots. If people are interested, I recommend to go onto the website and have a look at. There's a variety of ways that you can help in various ways.
All right, so thank you so much for sharing a little bit of your story with us. Congratulations on achieving your master's degree, and best of luck with the rugby. You've lots on the horizons there as well, and congratulations as well just for your ongoing work as an ambassador.
And just to mention that there is a new TV series coming out on Sky Atlantic and HBO in May, which is actually based on the Chernobyl disaster, and that's coming out on the 7th of May in Ireland, and the Global Children's International and AD are actually launching that today over in New York, and they're backing us 100%. So that is definitely something to look out for, and it will reveal the true events of what happened at that time.
It sounds like it's going to be a really interesting series indeed. So, Risa, thanks so much for joining us on Spirit
Radio. Thanks very much, Wendy.
Thank you. That's Chernobyl survivor Risa Carolyn there speaking to us, and she's also an ambassador for Chernobyl Children International. If you want to support their work and find out more about the work that they do, you can go to ChernobylInternational.com. And I believe, as well as that, A.D. Roach, who we've spoken to on this programme, an incredible young woman, is going to be speaking at an event in the UN in New York today. And I believe President Higgins and Tánaiste Coveney are going to be giving statements too, really just emphasising how Irish people have taken Chernobyl and its victims to heart, and just the incredible work that organisations like the Chernobyl Children's International have done over the years, and how we still need to keep that work up. Well, there's nothing like the drama and tension as the last seconds tick down to the kickoff or the throw-in at a major sporting event, whether you're actually there in person or whether you're sitting at home watching it on TV. The Grand Slam decider, the All-Ireland final, the World Cup final. There's definitely, even already, many sporting moments I can think of where I have been on the edge of my seat. And I think it's kind of gotten even more exciting as technology advances and we have even more kind of high-tech cameras and slow-mo and zooming in and all that sort of stuff. But one thing that's probably hard to imagine is to get into the mindset of what are the players thinking? What are they feeling? What must the adrenaline pumping through their veins be like? But one person that we must think of and spare a thought for, who is on the pitch but doesn't have a single supporter in the stadium other than probably family and friends, and I think of all the millions watching on TV, of course, is the referee. Our next guest knows exactly what it's like to be the man in the middle, having been an international rugby referee for 13 years, from 2001 to 2014, and having taken charge of, among many things, the Rugby World Cup final in 2007. And now he's the boss to the world's top referee. So pretty interesting career to date. In studio to tell us a little bit more about professional sport through the eyes of the referee, we have World Rugby's High Performance Match Official Manager, Alain Rowland. Alain, thanks so much for joining us in studio today.
Pleasure, Wendy.
All right, so tell us a little bit about how you became a referee. Was it something that you kind of had planned on?
Absolutely not, no. Well, it's funny, a lot of guys that I've spoken to wouldn't necessarily have planned it. And one of the challenges that we have is, like in any sport, is trying to get more referees into the game. We would try and target ex-players.
Is it difficult to try and attract referees?
Yeah, it is, insofar as a lot of people think that it's an unenviable job. There's not much satisfaction in it. We get nothing but, you know, hassle or grief. But it's the complete opposite. I mean, it's...
Because that's what people see oftentimes, is the ref getting the shtick, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Whether it's from the crowd, the players...
Well, as you said, as part of your intro, you know, we only seem to have fans and maybe family and friends has been our supporters. It depends on the decision we make, because when we make a decision, half the crowd will love you for it and then the other half won't. And then when we make another one, well, then it might be the reverse. But it's more about the way I look at it. It hasn't been an ex-player. I would never have... I would have been of that view that who would want to be a ref.
And as a player, from the player's perspective, how do you see the referee?
Yeah, you know, and a lot of the times the referees that would have been refereeing my games, you know, I would have had zero respect for them whatsoever. But there were a number of referees that I had a huge amount of respect for. And that was down to how they control the game, how they communicated with us, and we were able to follow and understand what they were actually doing. Where you get an awful lot of grief is when you've got a referee that you just can't follow, you just don't understand, he can't communicate and so forth. So I got into refereeing by chance, because a ref didn't show up. I was asked to do a game and I kind of did it and I enjoyed it. The guys loved it when I did it. And
were you surprised that you enjoyed it, given your kind of attitude?
Yeah, I did. But I suppose in some ways I was trying to make sure that what I hated in the referees that I didn't enjoy refereeing me is that even for that one game that I didn't do what they did. I didn't do what annoyed me, you know, in effect when I was involved with those guys. So and I probably just let a lot more things go that probably should have. And that's one of the things that ex-players would have, is they would have this, you know, general feel for what's kind of involved. And but it's one of those things, we need to try and get as many, you know, all codes people seem to forget. If you don't have a ref, you don't have a game.
Explain that to us, Elaine, the importance of the referee in the game. Because, I mean, you're talking about the referees you do respect for and you didn't have respect for, depending on how well they did their job. And it's something maybe that people forget, is how important the ref actually is.
Well, yeah, I mean, the referees don't want to be the centre of attention. All right, unfortunately, the referee sometimes is, because he has made or she has made a mistake of some description that has been a game changer, and we make mistakes. But unfortunately, we're not allowed to make a mistake. You know, referees aren't allowed. We're not allowed to make a mistake. You can have a player can miss, you know, he could miss a penalty kick. He could miss three conversions. He could miss a tackle that led a player in to win, a game. Yet he will be selected more than likely the following weekend. But if a referee makes a mistake, everybody is out to, you know, it's very unforgiving. But the referees are aware of that, but I don't think the general public are a lot of the time.
Have you had that feeling over the years where you feel like, Jamie, I might have made a mistake and I'm still being kind of punished for it?
Personally speaking, we will make mistakes. I have made mistakes during the course of games, and you just have to move on from that. You can be heavily criticised in the media as a result of it, but again, you move on for that. You know, the great thing about our game is you'll have, you know, there's a game every Saturday or there's a game every weekend, so you move from game to game. But one thing we can sometimes get criticised for is that there isn't necessarily accountability. You know, that if a referee does make a mistake, well, then it's not really taken into account and he just gets another game. But it's not like that. You know, like, referees are accountable just like players are, and if a referee is going through, a bad patch where we see that decisions aren't good or he's having an influence on how games are going, well, then he'll be stood down for a while and helped to try and get back to where he was, because he's obviously good enough to be, you know, to be doing it in the first place.
So it was one thing to be kind of called in for, you know, last minute because they needed a referee. Obviously things moved on from there. Can you remember, your first time that you did a big international match and how you felt that day?
Yeah, my first test match, my career was quite quick. I mean, I started refereeing 98, 99. 2001, I got my first test match. I did Romania-Wales in the November, you know, series, as it would have been at the time. And then the following March, I was refereeing Scotland-France in my first Six Nations game. So it did happen quite quickly.
Do you feel the pressure in those games?
You do feel the pressure because you just don't want to be making a mistake, or you don't want to do something that's going to have a direct impact on the results. I mean, when you're doing matches, you want the teams to decide the outcomes and not necessarily me. You know, and that's what you're trying to prepare around not having.
And that's a big part of the job, but also one of the parts of a good referee's job, I presume, is also when you think of a sport like rugby, it's such a physical sport, and you have to consider patient safety as well in terms of how the players are playing.
Yeah, player safety is number one. For us, player safety is paramount. Everything comes, you know, after that. But our laws are there to protect the players, and once we follow, you know, the laws, and the players understand them too, that if they step outside that, well, then there's sanctions that will be taken into account. But everything that we do is based around to ensure that, you know, the game is played in a safer manner. But you've got to remember, it's a contact sport. So you're going to have collisions.
There's going to be
injuries,
yeah.
There are going to be injuries. You know, there's injuries in any contact sport. And people have got to be aware of that.
I have an image of what the locker room is like for the players, you know, before a big match, and the pep talk and all that sort of stuff and the mental preparation that goes into it. But how does a referee prepare for a game?
Well, we have our own. Everybody has his own routine. You know, his or her routine and how they kind of prepare. We're in the changing room with our two linesmen. If we're talking about a test match, there's a lot of people in, you know, an international, you know, changing room is very, very busy. A team will have its full squad and its backup, so there could be 30, 40 people in a team's dressing room. But for our match officials, we could have 10, 15 people in our changing room.
Because so it's busy.
It is really busy. You know, because we've got, you've got the referee, you've got his two linesmen or touch judges, ARs, whatever you want to call them. You've got the TMO, the television match official. He's kind of there involved as well until he's kind of go off into the van. You've got the four, the five, the six. They're the ones that look after the subs. You're going to have the referee manager from the union is going to be there. You've got the comms guys then to hook you up. You've got the TV guys to hook you up. So,
and is that something that's changed a lot over the years? I mean, when you consider when you started out, Elaine, in terms of just how much, you know, even the actual power of camera lenses and being able to like
zoom we're wearing cameras now. We have to wear TV cameras, you know, when we're doing games, whereas before that was never the case.
So people can see through your eyes essentially.
Yeah, well, we have these ref cams, you know, they're chest cams, and you'll see that there's a number of occasions where they're used to get certain images during the course of the game. But so now we have to, and in some cases, you know, the ARs, the touch judges, they have to wear them as well. So that's how technology has gone. You know, everybody wants to be in, you know, get as much.
Has it been a good thing, do you think?
I think there's been positives, but I think there's negatives as well, kind of around it. There's, you know, given the work that we have to do sometimes, if you've got 30-something cameras in a stadium, we have had occasions when an image which would have been very helpful for us during the game wasn't available to us, but we found it afterwards. You
and
know,
then
so,
how do you feel when you see that?
Yeah, well, look, you can only deal with what you're given.
You deal with the information that's in front of you there. What's it like just in terms of, because obviously over the years you've had to do lots of travelling. I imagine it's a highly pressurised environment at times. Is there more highs than lows?
There's all mostly highs, yeah. You know, there is. And if there wasn't, you wouldn't pursue it. And you just have to look at every time if you're at that level and you're going out to do an international game, you know, it's the reason why we do what we actually do. You know, it's for the love of it. And it's a great buzz for us too. And we want to be part of it. You know, there's nothing better. Having played, I suppose I'm a bit unique in some ways that I've played test rugby, you know, so having played test rugby and then being able to referee international test rugby.
Was there ever times where you wish I was playing as a referee?
Yeah, there were many times where you kind of, I wouldn't say get caught up in the moment, but would have been many times during games that I'd been refereeing that the teams would have been playing so well that you would say something or something would come across your mic where you were just in awe of what was actually going on.
Because you're enjoying the sport as well as doing
your job.
You're just
enjoying the moment. And that's the critical thing. We're there to enjoy it too. We're there to do a job, but it's, you know, there's a huge enjoyment factor, you know, for us in the whole thing too.
Have you many kind of matches that kind of come to mind when you think of your most memorable ones?
I remember the first rugby championship, or would have been the Tri Nations game I did in 2003, which was phenomenal. It was in South Africa. It was South Africa and New Zealand, and just the whole build up to it, the atmosphere was just incredible. I'd looked at my two touch judges who were actually in floods of tears because of just the hype, the emotion coming out of the crowd. Like it was pretty incredible.
And how far in advance do you know I'm going to be going over to South Africa for this match?
It's pretty good, you know, for those games. For the Southern Hemisphere, for the long haul travel, probably 2-3 months in advance, you'd know, you know, that there's you're going to be selected. They make the appointments available to you. The other appointments are probably done. You generally know your calendar 6-7 weeks in advance.
One of your most famous decisions was sending off Sam Warburton in the World Cup semi-final in 2011. You didn't have any hesitation. Would you do anything differently if you could rerun that day?
No. You know, we talked about player safety. You've already raised it earlier, Wendy, in one of the questions that you asked me, and we were very clear that there are certain actions that aren't acceptable, and at the time he did an action that was totally unacceptable, and there was player safety, was which we said was paramount, and as a result of that he gave me no choice. And if I had to do it all over again, you'd have the same outcome.
One of the things that you're obviously doing now is training other referees, right?
Well, I work with other unions because my job now is to try and ensure that we have referees at international level in peak condition when they have to step out. And
so what do you look for?
Well, you know, they have to be good communicators, they've got to be good decision makers, they have to be good athletes to be able to get around the park.
Because it is a very physically demanding job as well, you know.
Yeah, like we wear GPSs too, you know, like we wear GPSs just like players do, and a lot of the times the guys, we could run between 7 and 9 Ks, you know, in a game. We also have heart monitors, which kind of gives us good input, good information back afterwards, you know, which again helps with the whole training side.
You can see your stress levels depending on
the
game.
Well, you can see when you had to make certain decisions as to where you were fit from a physical point of view,
The World Cup, of course, is coming up this autumn. What can we expect? What are your thoughts on the tournament in Japan?
I think it'll be phenomenal. You know, for anybody who's lucky enough to get out there, I think it'll be an incredible tournament. They're doing a huge amount of work. It's been really well received. Been out there a couple of times already, and we're all kind of very excited about it. The ticket sales are going beyond expectations. I'd say we'll have, you know, close on 100% attendances at all the games, all the venues. The Japanese, they just love the rugby, you know, and that's in addition to all the public, you know, the people that are going to be travelling to the games. You know, there's a very strong base, you know, of Japanese who want to go to it anyway. And they're huge supporters of it, and it'll be
a once in a lifetime trip for those who can make it over to Japan. Finally, I have to ask you, of course, for someone who is listening and really interested in your career, if they wanted to try and pursue a career as a referee, what's the best way to go about it?
Every union or each province has got a local association. So we're in Leinster. So the Leinster branch of referees hold a workshop every August, you know, and we would have, or you just get in contact with the Irish Rugby Football Union, you know. So if anybody wanted to find out a bit more information on it, you can go onto the website, and it'll give you all the information that you need, and you'd be invited to come along to one of our seminars, and then you can decide yourself whether you want to do it.
Well, who knows where Matthew, my son, he's only two, but he's doing his rugby tots with daddy tomorrow, so who knows what lies ahead of him. He's loving it, that's for sure. If you just joined me, I've been talking to former international referee and World Rugby's high performance match official manager, Alain Roland. Thanks so much for sharing with us the life of a referee on Spirit Radio this morning.
Pleasure, Wendy. Nice talk.
The maverick leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, met with Russian President Vladimir Putin yesterday at the Russian city of Vladivostok off the Pacific coast. The summit was actually the first ever between Putin and Kim and has the potential to change the way the world at large relates to this isolated and potentially lethal nation state on the edge of Asia. While international diplomacy is always extremely complicated, on hopes this marks some sort of further thawing of relations between North Korea and the rest of the world. But is that actually the case? On the line to give us his thoughts on the relevance of this meeting and if it will achieve anything, we've author and former foreign correspondent with Time magazine, David Aikman. David, good morning to you.
Good morning, Wendy. Thank you for inviting me on the program.
How significant do you think this meeting was, David?
Well, I think it may be less significant than it looks at the outset, because Kim Jong-un wanted a way out of this apparent impasse with the Americans and with Trump, and he hoped that Putin could give him a lifeline to kind of get rid of all the sanctions that the Americans still have imposed upon North Korea and find a way out. But although the meeting took an hour, actually it took twice as long as had been anticipated, the only thing that came out of it was that Putin agreed to support the return to the sixth power conference arrangement that North Korea had been in and the United States had been in, but which hadn't worked out. So that's not a particularly promising step forward.
What do you think that they were hoping to get out of the summit, and what actually was the result?
Well, clearly Kim Jong-un was hoping Putin could corral China, Japan and South Korea and everybody else into the six-nation sort of traffic jam that had been very ineffectual in dealing with the whole issue of North Korea's nukes. And Putin agreed to do that, but it's very unlikely the Americans will follow up and will respond. I mean, they may reluctantly agree to come back, but the American approach has been that the sixth way, that this multilateral six-party conference has had no effect whatever on changing North Korea's behavior.
So you don't think there's any thawing of relations between North Korea and the rest of the world with this summit?
I don't think so, no. I mean, nothing I see from it. I mean, it's okay, good that he met Putin. He got support for his more intransigent attitudes towards the United States. Putin probably had a shoulder, offered his shoulder to weep on about how difficult it was dealing with this prickly character Trump. But I don't think it's going to lead to any new development to thaw the Korean Peninsula from its nuclear vice-like grip held, of course, by the North Koreans.
So bringing it back then, David, just to Donald Trump, do you think it's going to have any impact there in terms of helping or hindering President Trump's efforts to persuade Kim Jong-un to step back from his nuclear program?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, the thing about Kim Jong-un is that the nuclear program is his key to staying in power. He is terrified that if he gives up nuclear weapons, I mean, he says he's frightened of an American invasion. He's not seriously frightened of that. What he's frightened of is losing power in his own country. And he thinks that the nuclear possession of nuclear weapons is his sort of magic spoon for warding off all other threats to his regime. And he's correct. It is a magic spoon because nobody wants to prick Kim Jong-un into possibly using nuclear weapons.
Do you think, I mean, what will Vladimir Putin be going back and saying when he's in Russia? Presumably he's still going to be lauding this summit as a major achievement.
Well, yes, he is. I mean, it is an achievement in the sense that he spoke with a leader of one of the most xenophobic and isolated countries in the world, and that proved that Russia is really important on the diplomatic map of the world, which is true. But I don't think it's going to do anything in practical terms.
Do you think that they're going to meet again, Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un?
It's certainly possible, but given the fact that Kim Jong-un can only travel overseas or to any other foreign country by train because he's so paranoid about flying in aircraft, I don't think Kim Jong-un is going to be going anywhere else very soon. I mean, where he took a train to get to Singapore through Malaysia, China, and he got to Vladivostok in Russia, and, you know, that's the furthest he's going to go. So I don't anticipate him wandering into the marbled corridors of the United Nations building anytime soon.
Do you think then, David, much of these summits, you know, as you mentioned, that probably hasn't really achieved much, are they much more for show than for actually achieving anything?
Well, I think so, because I'm quite sure that Kim Jong-un calculated that by visiting Putin and being welcomed by Putin and the guard of honor and everything, he's putting diplomatic pressure on Trump and the Americans to loosen up their rigid demand for a complete denuclearization program, which they have not apparently come up with, or at least they certainly haven't come up with enough from the American point of view to relax the harsh economic sanctions still on the regime.
And do you see any changes happening there in that regard?
Sorry?
Do you see that any of those changes that Kim Jong-un would like to see through shows like these summits happening?
No, I don't see any likelihood of a relaxation on the American side, because the Americans will have discounted this Putin summit as just a sort of flash in the pan to try and distract people's attention from the fact that there is a real impasse in the relationship between the two countries.
And that doesn't look like it's going to change anytime soon, David.
I don't think so, no. I mean, you can never tell because Trump is a very skillful negotiator, and he may put a slice of bread in some form in front of Kim to move the process along a bit forward, a little bit more. But I don't think anything is going to happen unless basically Kim concedes that he's got to come up with a full denuclearization program, a schedule for it.
Very interesting indeed, David. As always, thank you so much for your commentary on that meeting there. That was David Aikman just talking about the meeting between Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un, that summit that took place. And David is a former Time Magazine senior correspondent. Very interesting always to hear his thoughts.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.